Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again, I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the NASCA Stop Child Abuse Now Blog Talk Radio Show. NASCA stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Kim Lakin, and I am your host this evening, and my co-host this evening is Dr. Nancy. She's on with us, and we do have a very special guest that I will introduce in just a minute. Tonight, we are on scan number 3238. For our show, so you can look back at that at any time and get that off of the website. So we would also love for you to be a part of our panel. If you would like to call in, the guest call number, which is 646-595-2118, and be a part of our panel, and you're welcome to ask the guest any questions or, you know, just listen in online, so listen in live. So we'd love to have you. We have a single purpose here at NASCA, and that is to address issues that are related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. One, by educating the public, especially as it's related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, also known as CSA. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone, and two, by offering hope and healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone who's interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And again, we are on scan number 3238. We'd love to have you join us if you want to call 646-595-2118 and either listen in or be a part of the panel. We'd love to have you. And then my co-host, Dr. Nancy, will meet you on the back line if you call in, and then you can just tell her if you want to talk or if you want to just be a listener tonight. But, and you can, of course, access all of our shows on NASCA.org and just look up the number. So tonight's special guest is Barbara Albuquerque from Florida. Her mother, using heroin, gave birth to Barbara, who was born with withdrawals. Her father placed Barbara, only a few months old, with a friend who frequently hit her. About age 7 or 8, Barbara was severely beaten on the head. At 11, Barbara was placed with another woman. Her husband was one of the two men who repeatedly raped her. Barbara ran away, but police would always take her home. After running away again, she was placed in a foster care, and then in a group home where she met a heroin addict who started pimping her out at the age of 12. Barbara fought back. The man violently raped her and broke a bottle over her head. Oh, Barbara, you've been through so much. I'm so sorry. She managed to escape. The case went to the Supreme Court, where Barbara went through a rape trial by herself. And back in the group home, Barbara and two other girls were arrested and sent to a detention center for teenagers. She was released at age 16, and she went back to the original friend's house until she was kicked out at 18. With no skills, no emotional intelligence, and no family, she went to Miami, worked at a bar, and was again raped at gunpoint. She met a man who was a drug addict who was 14 years her senior, and she had two kids with him. Amid many violent fights, one resulted in stitches to her right eye. Her husband had an affair and left. Suffering severe depression, told an officer that she wanted to die, and the officer took her to where she received help. They gave her medication that helped her enough so that she had the mindset to move back to Miami with her two kids. Barbara started seeing a therapist as well, and just says that's the best thing that's ever happened in her life. So, oh my gosh, Barbara, you have been through so much, and I'm so sorry that your start in life, you weren't protected and loved the way that you should be, and we're so honored that you're here with us tonight to tell your story. So I am bringing you on now. You're live on air, and we are just excited to hear, you know, from your heart what happened, and feel free to share whatever you want and as little as you want as well. You can start, you know, just, I know that you're a returning member, so we, you know, I know you've done this before, but, you know, so we kind of start with your younger years and move through those, and then maybe we'll take a break and have our panel ask you a question if they have anything, and then kind of move through, you know, those middle years, and it sounds like every section of your life was just brought with a lot of trauma, and I'm so sorry that happened. And
thank you.
But, you know, we'd love to hear it. Thank you for being here, and we're honored to hear your story. So we'll let you go ahead and get started. Is there anything you wanted to say before you started your story?
Well, thank you for having me. It's the second time I do this. I did it, I think it was in 2019. Some time has passed, and I don't know if I can. I have mixed feelings about calling myself a survivor. Or a victim. I think, I don't know, I think that the word survivor, it feels like if I say I'm a survivor, I say that I'm okay, and I'm not okay, not by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 57 years old. I've come a long, long way. I statistically, I shouldn't be where I am, so I'm very, very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in foster care. I grew up, you know, the first 10 years of my life, I was with non-relative caregivers, and then ended up in the foster care system. My mother died from a heroin overdose. So my siblings and I, we were all separated. I just met my brother in 2011. My brother on both my mother and my father's side. Looking for him, I found that I had other siblings on my father's side that I didn't know anything about. So when I was living with the friend that my father placed me with, I don't know the stories. I do know that I have my passport. I know that she took me out of the country when I was 2 years old. So she lost touch with my father, which he used to visit me. So when my mother died, I was 6 years old, but I was already out of her custody since I was a little baby. At one point, we went from New York City. I was born and raised in New York City. We went from New York City to Dominican Republic. Then we went to Puerto Rico, where I was about 10 years old the first time I was molested. This man touched me. All he did was touch me. My father's friend, her name was Lucila. She was in the Dominican Republic. She left me. She would leave me a lot here and there and everywhere. I bounced back and forth from house to house a lot. And when she came back, they told her that they seen me in this room. and this man was touching me. So her, what she did was she just gave me a beat down. I remember I was 10. She gave me a beat down because I was molested. And
oh my gosh, like
there,
it was your fault or something.
Right. I had you know, I want to say, I'm not justifying what she did, but I want to say that it was like a cultural thing, you know, where they would just beat the kids. I'm not justifying her ignorance or anything, but like they would blame the child, you know.
Right.
And
right.
And so then she left. Then she left again to Dominican Republic, again leaving me with another family. For some reason, I acted out. I was, mind you, by this time I had already been beaten many times. I had one time where she broke my skull, and I was bleeding out of my head. It must have been around 8. Another time they had made me a stool for me to do the dishes, again around 8, and I cut my hand really bad. While I was doing the dishes, another time while she was working, because she used to work from inside the house, she left me butt naked under a table with her tablecloth. I guess she didn't want me to bother her customers. And I remember being under that table naked and peeking through the tablecloth. And some of her customers actually looking at me like, wow, is there a little naked girl under there? So those things I remember vividly. And then when she left me with this other family in Puerto Rico and she went again to the Dominican Republic, again, I started acting out. I started stealing the lady's jewelry, and I sold them for like $7 at the school. I remember that. And so they put me on a plane, sent me to the Dominican Republic where she was. And again, her punishment was to leave me butt naked inside her house. Then she went back to New York City. She took me back to New York City, but she had to leave again to the Dominican Republic where she left me with her daughter. By this time I'm 11. Her daughter was married to a man named Nelson, or she was living with a man named Nelson. And he raped me. He came into the bedroom where I was in and raped me one night. And I ran away. And the police found me. They took me back to her house. He raped me again. But before that happened, she must have noticed that something happened because she gave me a beat down. And I remember her neighbor, the lady's name was Cookie. She was married. She was a Puerto Rican lady married to an American man, skinny, small lady. When this woman was giving me the beat down, Cookie, like, she got in the middle, like, she intervened, and she got her butt whipped, but she got me away from her, because this woman was going to kill me. I was about 10, 11 years old, and so then he raped me again, second time, and I ran away again, and time when I ran away, the police found me, but they didn't take me back to her house, they took me to foster care. I was with this family. And I didn't stay there very long. I remember the lady calling the social workers, telling her, come get this kid out of my house. So when they came, they picked me up. They took me to a group home in Brooklyn, 1463 Pacific Street, Brooklyn, New York. It was the brownstone. And there was, I don't know, there must have been like 10, 15 girls. And we could go in and out as we wished, you know, there was no structure, zero structure. And I met a girl named Pee Wee out on the street. She didn't belong to the group home. She didn't work there or anything. She was from the neighborhood and, she started trafficking me and, to pay for her heroin addiction. She would do this very frequently. And, I remember she had a couple of regulars, and I remember this man named KK. I don't think now I know in retrospect when I think about it, he was her dealer. She would go there and shoot up heroin while I went in the bedroom and had sex with this man many times. And at one point she had to stop going there because while I was there, two men came in with guns and took all his things. I remember this very vividly, and she was in the other room shooting up dope. And after that, she couldn't take me there anymore. I'm assuming because of what happened. So she started taking me to other men's house. And there was this one man that this is the first time that I saw them exchanging money, because KK didn't give her money. He gave her dope. And when she got up to leave, I said, oh, I'm leaving with you. You know, I got up to leave with her. And she's like, no, I'm coming right back. No. I'm like, please, I'm leaving with you. I'm 11 years old. And by this time I'm 12. So I turned 12 in the foster care home. And I'm like, no, I want to leave with you. And she's no. And she left me there. And she left. I'm coming right back. And he had his way with me. I fought him, but he was a lot stronger, a lot bigger, and he raped me violently. And this man had, pardon the description, but he must have had like the biggest penis I've ever seen, and it hurt so much. I was in so much pain. I don't know how he didn't kill me. Like, I don't know how that didn't kill me. I have a lot of flashbacks lately.
PTSD. Barbara, do you want to take a break? Because I know you've said a lot of really hard things. Do you want to breathe for just a minute? And we did see if anybody maybe has questions, or do you want to keep going?
I'll keep going.
Okay.
It must have been like 2:00 in the morning. This happened February 9th, 1979. So mine is the middle of winter in New York City. And he fell asleep, and I ran out the door butt naked, but I ran upstairs. He was on the first floor. I ran upstairs instead of outside because I was butt naked, and I started banging on doors. Nobody opened the door. But, oh, my God, God is so good, because I found the door that was unlocked. And I went in, and it was a vacant apartment. And I locked myself in that apartment, and I hid behind a door, and I was there for hours. And in the morning, when daylight came around, I heard the door open, and this man comes in with a maintenance uniform on, which I'll tell you something. Please remind me later to tell you something about the maintenance uniform. When he saw me, like, I still remember to this day the fear in his face, like, oh my God, where did you come from? You know, like, how did you get in here? You know? And he ran out of that apartment like he saw, I don't know. And when he came back with the police. And I remember the police officer putting something over me, like a shirt or something. And I told the police officer what happened, and they went downstairs and arrested the man. I remember them taking him out in handcuffs and then taking me in a gurney to the hospital. And I remember going to the hospital and doing whatever they were doing. And I don't know if it was that same day or the next day, two of the girls from the group home came to visit me, Monica and Annette. And mind you, I'm 12 years old. I'm all alone in the world. Like, I was literally all alone in the world. And Monica's like, oh, come on, let's go back home. Let's go to the group home. You don't need to be here. So I left the AMA, what they would consider AMA, Against Medical Advice. I got up and I left with the girls. I went right back to the same group home. And they left me there in the same group home, right where, you know, right there. I went right back there. They took me right back there. And I stayed there. I went right back there. And I stayed there and with the girls and went through a trial because he had the audacity to plead innocent. Went through a trial. I was all by myself. I mean, I don't know if any of you ever had any kind of court cases or anything, but it could be very intimidating. And I was there all by myself. 13. Yeah, by this time I'm 13 because this happened February 9th. My birthday was March 25th. So I went through a trial. He was found guilty, and he was sentenced to 1 year in prison. And from there, I'm starting to act out. Monica and Annette, the two girls, my friends from the group home, we started acting out, and I got arrested in Manhattan and went to Spofford, where I was diagnosed with gonorrhea. I thought I was dying, infirmary, and they diagnosed me with gonorrhea. Here I am, 13 years old, with gonorrhea in Spofford. Went to court.
Not really knowing probably even what it is, I'm sure, at 13.
Yeah. And I remember I was in so much pain. I thought I was dying. That's all I remember. And they took me to the infirmary, and they put me on penicillin. And I remember them telling me what was wrong with me. And after Spofford, when we went to court, they sent me to South Lansing, which was a minimum security detention center, being out really bad. So they took me to Tryon, which was a maximum security detention center. And I stayed there till I was, I was 16. It was like a few days before my 16th birthday, where they took me back to Lucila's house, the original lady that had left me with her daughter. Social services, right? It's the foster care system. It's the social workers, right? Genius idea to take me right back where everything started. You've been raped so many times while you're a child, like it's very, you're like a magnet to it. You're a magnet. You like, and you don't even know what you're doing. So anyone that wanted to have sex with me would have their way with me. It was not until I was in my 40s that I realized that it was not my fault, you know, because I thought my whole life was my fault.
Yeah. Well, no, you felt like it was love. That was the way that you felt love, you know, because that was the only way that you were taught is to have that. And unfortunately, you know, it's like when you're little like that and something happens, you know, sexually to you, then you're like more hyper aware than any other child your age. And so, you know, it's not, yeah, just so you know,
I've had a lot of therapy. I've had a lot of therapy.
But
so I know a little bit. I've read a couple of books that have actually helped me a lot. The Body Keeps the Score, The Road Less Traveled were the two that have helped me the most. And I remember I was talking to my most recent therapist about this because I remember, and I'm going to jump forward a few years after my divorce, me coming to Florida, me wondering, why doesn't anybody want to have sex with me? You know, why am I standing here? I was standing in front of a cigarette store. And why am I standing here and nobody is approaching me trying to get me into their car to have sex? It's
yeah,
because
you
become a magnet. You become a magnet for this. You're more prone to being abused 150 million times more than someone that's never been abused. And then when I went back to her house, Lucila's house, I'm 16. I started having an affair with a man that was 44, a friend of hers, pregnant. Had sex with everybody else that wanted to have sex with. He took me to the abortion clinic. He was married and had a family. I remember that. Pedro was his name. When I turned 18, she kicked me out of her house. By this point, I had just met a biological sister that I had on my mother's side. She was my oldest sister on my mother's side. We met when I was 18 years old, and she lived in New Orleans. And I remember her buying me a ticket, a one-way ticket to New Orleans. And when I got to New Orleans, actually when I called, her name was Deborah. She passed away last year. And when I got to somewhere in between New York City and New Orleans on the Amtrak train, I call her and tell her that I'm on my way. And she tells me, oh, I didn't know you was coming here. And I was like, oh, Lucila bought me a ticket, sending me to your house. I'm on my way to your house. And she's like, oh, really? I didn't know that. So when I get to New Orleans, I'm completely out of place. My sister, bless her heart, may she rest in peace, had her own trauma because, like I said, we were separated. So she had her own trauma. She's 24 years old. I'm 18. She just gotten married, and she had a lot of trauma. My mother left her in the hospital. And accordingly, her father is the one that turned my mother out to heroin when my mother was 15 years old. So my sister had her own heavyweight trauma. So I stayed there for like 2 months. I was working in this salon where everybody talked about Miami and Miami and Miami and Miami. And some man asked me that I want to move to Miami. And I'm like, sure. And I want to move to Miami. I was in her house. I was in Deborah's house for less than 2 months, got in a car with this man, and where the whole ride from New Orleans to Miami, he had his way with me, of course. And ended up dropping me off in Miami and some lady's house that I didn't know. And she was some type of a madam or something. So I ended up leaving her house. And I ended up finding a little job at a bar where I was pulling tricks here and there to survive. And then I ended up getting a little apartment, getting a boyfriend that used to beat me up. That was normal, I guess, at the time.
That was, yeah, you're normal, but you knew. That's normal.
And
yeah.
He ended up getting killed, shot in the chest. His friend, a friend of his, I ended up hooking up with him, which probably saved my life. He was a drug addict, 14 years older than me, so we had a very turmoil relationship. We were together for like 15, 16 years. We had two kids. I have two adult children. And
I was going to say, yeah. Because at that point, did you have children, or it wasn't until you... But it wasn't until you met that guy that you started having your
no,
kids.
No, I didn't have any kids.
So you were in your 20s?
I was 20 years old when my daughter was born. Because I had just arrived in Miami. I left New York when I was 18. Went to New Orleans with my sister. Ended up staying there a couple of months. Things didn't work out. I left. I went to Miami with this man that offered me a ride. Hey, you want to go to Miami? I'm like, sure, I'll go to Miami. You're 18. Sure, I'll go to Miami. And I remember he gave me a ride to my sister's house, and I went over there to pick up my suitcase. And I walked in, and I'm like, oh, I come to get my suitcase. I'm going to Miami. And she's like, what? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to Miami. I'm moving to Miami. Like, I didn't know her. I had just met her a few months earlier when she came to New York to meet me, when she's the one that actually kind of found me, kind of, per se. My biological grandmother on my mother's side, I met her when I was like 18. I had just turned 18. I met her, and then she brought Deborah over, and I met both of them. And then, like, my biological grandmother lived in New York, but I didn't have, like, we weren't close or anything. I had just met her. I wasn't going to go to her house or anything. Nobody offered to send me to her house. So he offered to send me to Deborah's house in New Orleans, and that's what happened. And I ended up moving to Miami, and then in Miami, I worked in this bar, and I just had these jobs, you know, like here and there in the bar. And I went to a couple of different bars working. And then I had these kids. I got pregnant. I was with him. We ended up staying together for a long time until he left me for my neighbor. We had a very, very volatile relationship, a lot of fights, a lot of hitting. He threw a remote one time that cut me right on the eye. I had like 6-7 stitches under my right eye. A lot of disrespect. He was a horrible husband, but I was a horrible wife because I didn't know anything about anything. You know, like I'm not.
Well, no.
I mean, you know, you know.
You didn't know how to react at all. Yeah.
I didn't know how to react because
she never saw.
Yeah. Yeah, I would throw a lamp across the room without, like, I have no idea how I managed to get by through my 20s without any major incidents. I mean, I had one arrest for domestic violence, but, like, nothing worse than that, you know? Nothing worse than that, which that was pretty bad, you know? An arrest for domestic violence is not good, mm-hmm. but it was, like I said, nothing worse than that, except we got divorced. Excuse me?
Oh, go ahead. When you got divorced. No. Yeah, I was going to ask you if maybe I could ask you a question here in a minute.
No,
but
go ahead and finish
your sentence.
No, I was just wondering. No, I said when I got divorced, like I said, like worse than the arrest was when I got Baker acted by that cop that took me to the hospital, and he Baker acted me. It's the one and only time I've ever been Baker acted. Like I said, I have no idea how I went through this time in my life, my 20s, and my early 30s without any major consequences of, in the sense of having DCF involvement or getting my children taken away or getting just with a domestic violence arrest and one Baker Act after the divorce through undiagnosed major depression my entire 20s. And I didn't know I was depressed. I thought that's the way I was supposed to feel. Like, I had no idea. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything else. So I look back so many times. I look back and I wonder how that happened. Because statistically, I really should not be here. Like, statistically, when I met my brother in 2011, I found him on the streets of New York City, HIV positive, homeless, and a heroin addict. And statistically, that's where I should be, you know, or in prison or dead somewhere. So I still wonder sometimes how I made it through those years.
Do you feel like there is somebody that was around in your life that showed you a different way? I mean, you've talked a lot about all the abuse and stuff, too, but I think, you know, one time, I just wonder if, because you're questioning where your morals came from, and I think a lot of times if we aren't raised with them, you know, we've seen them at some point in our either childhood or, you know, early adulthood. And so we know the right thing to do. I think that's what a lot of people that come on the show are about. I mean, they've decided to do something instead of just letting it all happen. You know?
Well, times I think about, okay, like I've thought about this a lot. Like Lucila, the lady that I grew up with the first 10 years of my life and ended up going to her house, like she didn't treat me very nicely, but I saw her treating other people nicely. I saw the way she treated other people from her family. I heard her, the way she talked about a lot of things, which have stayed with me. A few of those things stayed with me. And so I observed the way that she treated her biological grandson, which I consider my brother to this day, because we grew up in the same household. She raised him. She treated him a lot different than she treated me, but he was a child himself. It wasn't his fault. I remember many things that she would say not to me, to other people that I would hear, because children are sponges. And I remember a lot of those things that I would hear in her house, that I heard in her house. And it's not just the morally, it's, and I hate the word lucky because I think it undermines everything that you go through. I would prefer the word fortunate. So I was really, really fortunate. And I'm happily married now. I've been married for 12 years to this amazing man, that's a God-fearing man. And he grew up in the church where I didn't. But I remember there was this one lady, her name was Maribel. She was the daughter-in-law to Lucila. And I remember she gave me a Bible when I was like, I don't know, I must have been like 9 years old, because I was a kid and I had this Bible till I was in my 30s. And I never read it, but except the one page where the Lord's Prayer was, where she showed me that and highlighted it. And I remember always praying since I was a little girl because that lady showed me that. And I don't think it was everything that any like moral thing as much as that I always, and I always is an absolute, and I don't like to use absolute, but I always thought about the future. I always imagined the future. For some reason or another, I always imagined the future, and I truly know that that had a lot to do with my, even though I wonder, but I don't know if that makes sense, but on the same, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, I feel like I know that that was it, was my ability to imagine the future. It was constant in my life. So go ahead.
Yeah, can we ask you a few questions? Is that okay?
Yes.
If anybody else has any?
Okay.
Yeah, thing I wrote down was, so your birthday is in March, and my birthday is in March as well, so we are first month sisters. I love that.
I'm an Aries.
Okay, so you went right into that other one. Yeah, no, I'm a Pisces, but we're still in the same month.
Yes.
And, yeah, I think that that, when you said that she gave you a Bible, I just went, oh, because that was my experience as well as a young child, as I was introduced to Jesus, and I think that that changed my whole perspective and being able to kind of put things into place. I agree with you. I don't feel like I am completely healed either. I mean, there are definitely moments that it's just, it still comes back to you. I mean, the PTSD stuff from your trauma is going to probably be there. And I think when you start to realize that that's normal, you know, we talk about that sometimes on here, it's normal, even though it's not, but it's normal for everything that you've been through. And then that gives you kind of the ability to give yourself some grace. And yeah, I think that everything that you've gone through has been, you know, horrific. And for you to be able to raise children and then be married to a wonderful man, you know, yeah, God was on your side, I think. I think he was the whole time.
Oh, he was. So, he was, yeah. He was carrying me the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other thing that I wrote down is when you were talking about you don't want to necessarily think of yourself as a survivor, have you ever heard the word thriver?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Because I think thriver, T-H-R-I-V-E-R. So you know what?
Right.
You are thriving at life because you have gone through these experiences and you are not going to be just, you know, held down by all of them. So you're amazing and you give yourself a little bit more credit. Have you ever heard of the ACES study?
Yes.
A-C-E-S. Have you heard of it?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I love that study. Yeah, the ACE
score. I think I score about an eight.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. I wouldn't be surprised if you got all 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that you had to go through all of that. You just weren't able to have a childhood that you should have been able to. But I'll bet you tried really hard for your kids. I'm sure you weren't perfect. None of us are, but I'm sure you tried really hard to get them.
Mm-hmm. I tried really, really hard. One of my favorite quotes in the world is by Maya Angelou. Now that I know better, I do better, because they have a lot of generational trauma. They saw me at my worst. They've also seen me at my best now. They have paid a lot of the consequences of my trauma in the sense that they have carried it. I did not raise my kids like my sister did. May she rest in peace. My sister raised her kids, and she told her children knew about her past from the time they were children. My children didn't know about my past until they were adults.
Yeah.
So
I did that thing.
Yeah, so I wasn't one to share with them anything. My mother died from, my parents died in a car accident. Both of them died in a car accident, according to me, right? Where my father didn't die from a car accident, from anything. My father died from colon cancer. I found out that he died from colon cancer when I was, when I found my brother. I was looking for my brother and my father, and I found out that he had died from colon cancer 20 years prior. So it's been like 32 years because I found my brother 12 years ago. But my whole life, or my children's whole infancy, whenever my parents would come up, the subject of my parents, so they died in a car accident. The fact that my mother died from a heroin overdose was not something that I shared with them until I'd say maybe 10 years ago when they were in their 20s. So it wasn't something that that I shared. I remember having a little falling out with my sister over this, because she insisted that the truth was better. And I told her that she raised her kids her way. I raised my kids my way. So my children didn't know why I behaved the way that I did. Or my daughter, she's a recovering alcoholic. She's got 100 days sober this time around. She excelled at school when, I remember when she was 6 years old, her teacher's name was Miss Reed. We were living in Vegas. We lived in Vegas for 13 years. And I remember when she was in the first grade, her teacher telling me that my daughter was an avid reader and an avid writer and showing me her journal. And I had absolutely no idea what I was looking at, you know? Oh, really? I mean, I got my GED in my 40s after my daughter graduated from high school. So I had absolute, I mean, I had a third grade level reading. And so I started teaching myself how to read. School was not an option when I was growing up, as you can imagine. So when Miss Reed told me that my daughter, you know, had all these talents, I was like, oh, okay, you know. Then when she went to the second grade, Miss Weber called me one day and told me, asked me permission if she could test my daughter for the gifted program. And I'm like, sure, you know, sure, be my guest, you know. Mm-hmm. And so she got a really high score. She was in the gifted program for her entire elementary years, and then went on to excel from there. And my daughter is a first generation high school graduate, first generation college graduate. She's a professor now, but she battles with alcohol. So the generational trauma is there. And like I said, she's got over 100 days sober this time. And I think this time is the real deal, you know. She's going to AA every day. Every day she goes to a meeting every day. My son didn't like school that much. He was able to graduate and got a nice little job, but he's got a family. A really nice family. I have a grandson and a granddaughter that both have autism, but my grandson, grandson is 9 years old. Yeah, he's going to be 10 soon. And in 2017, when my mental health was really at its lowest, I would say, in my entire life, and I was having a lot of suicidal ideation. And just the thought of him is what kept me going. Like, just to think about my grandson being on this earth without me, just kept my mind straight, or as straight as could be. 2017, right after the, and I don't even remember if I shared this the last time that I spoke with you with the show. 2017, it was right after the, right before the Me Too movement. This has nothing to do with politics or anything, but this is what triggered this. When the tapes came out about touching a woman's vagina and all this et cetera stuff, I started having flashbacks. And then when the Me Too movement, it just got worse. My flashbacks got so bad. And I started thinking that I was going crazy and that none of this happened, that this was all in my head, that the rape didn't happen, the trial didn't happen, that it was my imagination. Mm-hmm. So I got on a plane and I flew to New York City and I went to the courthouse to try to find out if this was really true, because I thought I was losing my mind. And when I went to New York, they didn't have the transcripts because it had been too long, but they did have all the court dates of the trial, the judge's name, the defendant's name, my name. They had a lot of records that I acquired after going to like three or four places. The first courthouse I went to that I thought was the court, they told me, no, this is criminal court, it's in Supreme Court. This is how I realized that it was Supreme Court, because I went to the criminal court looking for my record from the trial, because I needed to know if these flashbacks were real. I needed to know. And so when I went to the courthouse, I got those papers, and then I went to the police station trying to get the police report. I didn't get that. I got it like 6-7 months later after a lot of letters and emails and notarized papers proving that I was who I am. And because it was a child, they couldn't give me that police report. I had to prove that I was that child. And why is my last name not my last name? And all that kind of stuff, you know? So it took me about 6-7 months to get that police report. And I got it in 2017. So mm-hmm. I was able to see that, okay, I'm not crazy. I have not lost my mind.
This was empowering, kind of.
Yeah, this did happen because I truly believe that I was imagining this, that I truly believe for a minute there that I tell you, I had suicidal ideation almost every day in 2017. I found a psychiatrist that helped me a little bit, and a therapist. And
can we?
Yeah.
Can I ask another question? Is it okay if we maybe
ask away? Ask away.
Yeah, there's a couple other people on the panel here, so I was going to see if maybe it was okay if we just opened it up to see if they would have any questions or anything they would like to say. And Dr. Nancy, I'm not able to open it up. So can you open those lines? My computer's doing something crazy. And it's not letting me get on there. So, yeah, if you have any questions, go ahead. So open the line and ask questions.
Barbara, do you volunteer for anything?
Excuse me?
Do you volunteer for anything?
Do I volunteer? Yes, I have volunteered. Guardian Ad Litem, I volunteered 2014. It wasn't a good fit, so I didn't last there. I volunteer for the special needs events when I see one. Volunteer for the feeding the homeless every now and again. But that's about the extent of my volunteer.
What help did you find release from the suicide idealization?
Did I sign a release?
Relief from the suicidal thoughts?
I'm sorry, I can't hear the question.
Did you get any relief or break from all the thoughts about suicide?
Relief or break? Yes. I haven't had any suicidal ideation since 2017. Like once in a blue moon, the occasional thought, but not very, very rare since 2017. I'm on medication, as you probably can assume. As a matter of fact, I just got my medication changed not too long ago, a few weeks ago, so I've been feeling kind of off. I didn't even know that I had, like, anxiety and stuff until recently. For about 10 years, I kept going to the cardiologist on and off through 10 years, thinking that I had something wrong with my heart because I'm a woman, I'm in my, you know, my 40s, smoker, you know. My chest hurts. Evidently, I have a problem with my heart, right? It's my assumption. So I kept going to the cardiologist, getting all these tests, and they kept telling me that my heart was fine. And then come to find out many years later, when I was working in the ER in the MAT program, Medicated Assisted Treatment Program, helping people that are addicted to heroin get treatment in the ER here in Florida. That's a whole nother story. One day I was psychiatrist and I was having chest pains and I thought I couldn't breathe, and she called the pharmacist and sent me to the ER, and here they got the wheelchair. And when I'm about 2 weeks before that happened, one of the clinicians that I worked with told me that my anxiety was off the chart. This is a clinician that had 20 years of experience. And when he told me that, my thought was, oh, he don't know what the hell he's talking about, you know? Of course, this clinician that has 20 years of experience doesn't know what the hell he's talking about when he tells me that my anxiety is off the chart, right? So I didn't pay him no attention. I'm like, okay, he don't know what the hell he's talking about. But then when this happened 2 weeks later, and Dr. Purdy sent the pharmacist to take me to the ER because my chest was hurting, and as she's wheeling me to the ER, Simone, she tells me, do you suffer from anxiety? And immediately what he had said to me 2 weeks before and what I had learned in behavioral health, I was working in behavioral health, which was something very new to me. I worked in housekeeping for 25 years. It all added together, and then it all came together. Like, it all came together, all the visits to the cardiologist. Like, that moment, something clicked, and I was like, wow, this is what's wrong with me? And it just all clicked together that day. This was February of 2020, right before the pandemic, when I realized that my chest pain, after years of having chest pains and thinking and keep going to the cardiologist to see if something was wrong, I realized that nothing was wrong with my heart. It was my anxiety and my panic attack. So I don't know if that answers the question, right, about volunteerism. But that's about as far as my volunteer has went. On Thanksgiving and Christmas, whenever I have leftover food, I'll pack them up in nice styrofoam things, and me and my husband will go and give it out to the homeless on the corner of 441 and Griffin. That's my street there. I don't know why that's the corner that I like. Like, I feel a certain connection. I gravitate to that corner. I think it's because, like, behind the Wawa, there's a lot of heroin addicts. And so I always gravitate to that corner. When I was 9 years old, Lucila, I went to Dominican Republic. She was, like I said, she went to Dominican Republic a lot. She left me here. She left me there. She left me everywhere. She left me with her teen children, and one of her teens, Ivan, he sent me downstairs, and I was 9 years old to go to the store. I was eight or nine. I wasn't even nine yet to go to the store. And we lived on 135th Street and Broadway, one of the busiest intersections in New York City. And when I crossed the street, when I was crossing the street by myself, a heroin addict, a junkie, for the sake of using that word, he crossed the street with me so that I wouldn't get hurt. But once he crossed the street and I was across the street, he left. So when I was crossing back, I got lost. I got lost, and I was lost in New York City, walking around New York City when I was nine. And then they found me a little while later. And I don't know why I was telling this story, but I don't know where I was going with this, but I remember that. And so, oh yeah, I remember now. Like, I gravitate towards the people that have problems and addiction. My mother died from a heroin overdose. So I gravitate toward them to try to help them. And it's, so that's the corner that I gravitate toward to go get the go take the food over there, because that's where I know a lot of them congregate, behind the Wawa and the other gas station across the street. So, yeah, that's the only volunteer. I'm working. I was, like I said, I was in housekeeping for many, many years. I told my story to someone at the hospital because I was the supervisor for housekeeping at Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital for a few years. And I told my story to someone not knowing who she was. And when I finished telling her my story, she offered me a job in behavioral health as a peer specialist. And I was like, oh, wow. When I told her my story, she said, do you know that we hire people like you? I'm like, oh, really? What does that mean? And she offered me a job. And she took a leap of faith in me, and I took a leap of faith also. And I accepted the job, and I started working in behavioral health with in the ER with people that came in with overdoses or withdrawing, and I tried to engage them into treatment. And I did that for like 4 years. Then I went to go work for BARC, a detox, and I did that for a year, and now I'm working with children as a peer specialist. So the jury's still out whether I'm going to be able to succeed with this, be able to stay long with this job, because it's a huge trigger to me. It's a huge, huge trigger. So I'm giving it my best shot. Because of my trauma, I've never really been able to stay at a job longer than a few years. I'm always in fight, flight, or freeze mode. So, and I see monsters where there aren't any. So I always end up leaving before I see any significant progress from my hard work. Because I work really hard. Like I said, I was in housekeeping for 25 years. So it's a change of career. So I've been in behavioral health now for 5 years, and I think I started this job, this particular job, 6 months ago. I had a little episode with one case about 3 months ago where I had to pull over because my legs were shaking, and I could barely drive, so I literally had to pull over into a 7-Eleven, so I calmed down because this case really, really got to me, and something that I've been working with my therapist, and have been able to identify what the triggers are, actually, exactly how they, at least those triggers. So I'm constantly working, trying to heal, but it's not that simple.
Thank you for answering the question.
Sure. Any other questions?
Yeah.
I'm an open book.
I want to say something really quick. I hope you have a successful healing feeling during your story. It's very inspiring.
You hope I have a successful what?
Successful healing journey.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm working. I like my current therapist very, very much.
What was that?
I said my therapist that I have now, my current therapist, because I've had like 20. I like her very much, very, very much.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. She works for Nancy Kahneman here in South Florida, which is an organization that is only for, like, that's what they do. And it's owned by the county, and she's been doing it for 8 years. I did my homework. I saw her about 3 years ago. I went to like 2 sessions with her, and then I never went back. And I started going back, and I went back about 4 months ago, and we've been able to connect really nicely this time around. So it's my second time with her.
Nice. Always good to have somebody that you can kind of rely on and feel comfortable with. There's so many therapists out there.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard to find that right person. I'm glad you did.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad that you found that.
So some of them are real quacks. And that's, like I said, I work in behavioral health, so I trust me, I know. Some of them are really quacks. I had one therapist, I had two sessions with her. I remember the first session, I was like, oh, my God, I love her. We're going to have great work together. I think we're going to do great work. It's going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. And then the second session, I was like, oh, I'll never talk to this lady again because I disagree with her about her assessment with my level of PTSD. And her answer to me was, I'm not going to debate that. And I was, okay, you're not going to debate that? Sure, I'm not going to debate it either. You're never going to talk to me again. you know, so
right, you have a choice.
Some of us,
yeah.
Well, you know, please don't debate it. Please, let's not ever talk again. Period. You know, I was in my 40s, when I first went looking for professional help. And I remember there was this show on HBO that I was watching with a friend of mine that I had at the time called Therapy or something, or The Therapist, something to that effect. And it was about a therapist. And we used to watch this show and we used to love it and we used to just have these long conversations, this friend of mine. And that's how it occurred to me, the idea, a few months later, that I needed to talk to somebody, because at this time I'm in my 40s, been divorced at this time for a few years, about 10 years. I'm still engaging in very unhealthy sexual relationships as a grown adult woman. And to the point where one day I was like, what is wrong with me? Something's got to give somewhere, something. I cannot continue to do this to myself and put myself through these horrific relationships, unhealthy relationships. And that's when I started looking for a therapist. And I was extremely, extremely fortunate because I landed this therapist that I saw her on and off for a few years. Her name is Lynette Fuller. I'm going to drop her name when I write my book. And I have to say that woman did her job because it helped me so much. It changed my perspective of a lot of things, specifically the fact that I realized that when this happened to me, I was a child, because my entire life I thought that it was my fault, that I was at fault for these things happening to me. I truly believe that. And she changed that perspective. She did her job. This lady did her job. So I was very, very, very fortunate to find her. When they're helping you and then you got to go look for somebody else, that's Dr. Scott Peck. She talks about that in one of his books. I read a couple of his books that my daughter recommended, actually. So I got very, very, very lucky, to say the word. I hate that word, but I got to say I got lucky. And I landed a really good therapist at that time in my life. After that, I haven't been that lucky. I've found a few here and there that were really good, but I've bounced a lot from therapist to therapist because I can't seem to connect. I just keep comparing them to maybe to her, or maybe to Brené Brown, or maybe to Dr. Scott Peck, or I don't know, to these people that I see and I hear about and I read about, and I'm like, okay, that's not the therapist for me, and I keep it moving, and then I go and I look for another one. But like right now, I landed a good one because I've been with her for about 4 months. I would say 4 months, every March, April, May, June. Yeah, I've been with her for 4 months consistently, every week, once a week, and I don't have any intention of leaving her. So I think I finally landed one. And like I said, this is the second time that I see her, because I was with her, I think it was 2019, maybe, a few years ago. I saw her a couple of times, and then I never went back, and then I went back to this organization because it's the best one in town when it comes to sexual assault. That's what they do. That's their specialty. That's their therapeutic you know, practice is sexual assault for children and women, you know, and adults, children and adults. So I went back again, and I'm happy that I did. I'm really happy that I did. Because this job working with the kids, like today I went to go visit a kid at a group home and he ran away, and, you know, it made me a little sad because even though it's a boy, you know, these things happen to boys too, you know, and I'm like, where is this kid? Where is this kid? You know, so it's a little triggering. It's a little triggering. So I'm handling it, but it's very hard sometimes. Sometimes it's very hard.
I'm sure. You feel it so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
They know that you are somebody that has been through that as well, though. So it's probably comforting to them eventually. You know, maybe not right
well,
in the moment.
I'm very selective who I share my story with when it comes to the patients or the kids or the clients. When I was working in the ER, there were, like, I would share my story to an extent as far as my mother dying from a heroin overdose. I grew up in foster care, you know, it broke up my family, the drug addiction, you know. But when it came to the other stuff, the sexual assault and the sex trafficking and the child sex trafficking and all that other stuff, I shared it with two patients. In the whole 4 years that I did that, like I said, I'm very selective who I share that with. I think that's also part of the training that I received when I, like I said, they took a leap of faith in me. They gave me a lot of training. They really did. I worked there for 3 years. I left for a couple of years, and now I'm back with the same hospital that I started out with, but in a different department. Now I'm working with the kids instead of the ER. And I remember the first patient that I shared my story with. He came into the ER very sick. He disclosed that he was using heroin, so they called me to go try to engage him into treatment. I went to bedside. I was with him. His wife was also at bedside. I stayed with him his whole time in the hospital. He was in the hospital for a couple of months because he had endocarditis. The infection from the intravenous drug use went to his heart. So he had open heart surgery. He had two of them in less than a month. He had a beautiful daughter at home with his wife. And he was going to leave AMA against medical advice. And this happened. He had been in the hospital now for like 3 weeks, a month. He was there for over 2 months. Because they don't let you go home when you have a drug addiction and you use intravenously and you need that amount of antibiotics. You have to stay in the hospital if they have to do it intravenously and through IV, right? Because you're an intravenous drug user, so you have to stay in the hospital. And he was going to leave AMA. I told him, if you leave AMA, I had a lot invested in him. I used to visit him every day, 5 days a week, the 5 days that I worked. I would go upstairs. I worked in the ER, but I went upstairs to his room to provide support. And I told him he was the first patient that I told my story to. I told him, if you leave here AMA, you are a heroin addict. You are a drug addict. Social workers going to call DCF. They're going to go to your house, and depending how that social worker feels when they go to your house, if she woke up on the wrong side of the bed, they're going to take your daughter and take her to foster care, depending on how she wakes up that morning, okay? And if your daughter goes care and they decide they don't want to give her back to your mother because they got a chip on their shoulder, okay, they have more power than God. Pardon my husband hates when I say that. If they have more power than God, Julio, you cannot leave here AMA. They're going to take your kid away, okay? And if she goes to foster care, this is what happened to me in foster care. And if you want that to happen to your daughter, go ahead and leave AMA. And he didn't leave AMA. He did not. And so, like I said, I'm very selective who I tell that part of my story to. And it's because of the training, part of the training. So I, to him, and it worked. It worked. So, and then to another person, and in my 7 months, I started in January that I've been working here, August 4th to be 7 months, that I've been working with the children. I've only told my story to one person. It was a parent, not a child. It was a parent that I told her my story because she kept saying that she wanted her daughter to leave for the state to take her. And I'm talking about her biological daughter. So I told her, well, you know, this is what happened to me when I was in foster care. You know, I don't know if that's what you want your daughter to go through, but this is what could happen to her. And 60% of the children that get trafficked in the United States of America come from the foster.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to you. You got the information that you need to make the best decision that you want, that you can make. You know, I did my due diligence. So whatever you do after this, you know, it's up to you. So I don't tell my story to too many people that I work with. Unless I have to.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, unless I have to.
Do you mind if I just make sure, you know, we're down to 12 minutes. Time goes so fast.
For
real? I know Dr. Nancy didn't have, we're 12 minutes out. So I didn't know if Dr. Nancy had anything that she wanted to ask before we close with you, because I know she's been hanging out.
I had no idea that I've been here so long.
Okay, you know,
hi,
it's a pleasure.
Nibble.
Hi. I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for opening up your story, your testimony. You know, there's so many things that you said that I wanted to kind of address, but, you know, one of the things that I can say is, you know, the same way I was introduced to God through someone else. My abuser's mother introduced me to the Lord. And so that's one of the things that helped to save me during those times at my lowest point. So, you know, you definitely have a very powerful testimony. And a lot of times I say this, there's been times that I've laid out on the floor and begged the Lord to use me as a vessel. And then I would get mad when things were going on and things were happening to me in my life. And I didn't understand why. But today I'm doing a lot of counseling work. I'm doing a lot of coaching work. Not, you know, you could do it under coaching. If you're a survivor, all of us are survivors. All of us are at a level where we can help someone else survive, right? We can coach someone through how to recover, how to survive. Even if we're still going through, it doesn't matter if we're still healing ourselves, because I'm going to tell you, recovery and healing is a lifelong journey. It never stops. You know, things can trigger you and take you right back into that whirlwind of something, a smell, a color. I know I was forced to eat rotten food at one time by this horrible older lady who my mom left me with for a year when she came to the United States. I'm originally from Costa Rica. And so when I would see the color orange, I never understood why I had this hatred for the color orange. But later on, you know, through opening up myself and digging into myself, I was able to, okay, I remember that right after she forced me to eat that old soup, it was a bright orange color, and I ate it, and I would throw up every time I would look at the kitchen curtains because they were bright orange. So, you know, there's triggers, there's things that we go through as children, abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, and so much trauma. And when we really start to do research, like I'm always studying and always in school, and I do it for my own recovery and my own mental health because I'm still in pain. Like I go through times that I'm giving, helping people in the area of suicide, helping people in the area of child abuse and all this stuff and sexual abuse. And those are all things that I have been through, right? So as I'm giving, sometimes I feel empty. There's times that I tap the bottom of the bottle and I'm like, wait a minute, I'm empty. But as I learn, I'm strengthening myself. And then I always meet someone who needs that, pour. So I refill myself. And then just remembering the importance of trying to make a little time for self-care. And I just think you're amazing. You're more than a survivor. I think survivor, even though I know that, you know, you're a survivor, a thriver, all those things that empower us, those who have been through abuse, and you're hope. You give us hope. Yeah, and you empower us to continue to survive and continue to get up through our trials. Again, your story is amazing, and I'm just honored to be able to sit in the room tonight and be able to hear your story as you pour into us and share with us. So transparent tonight, and that's just honorable. So are you on Facebook? How do people find you? How do we contact
Barbara
you?
Barbara Albuquerque, I'm on Facebook, yes, ma'am. And I'm friends with a couple of the groups from Alaska, like Mr. Murray, Kathy Jones. So you could, if you're friends with them, you could find me very easily. And before we go, since you made that correlation with the orange, I want to just really quickly, there was, when I said, remind me about the maintenance man, a story. This maintenance man that found me when I was 12 and I was hiding behind that door. So I didn't make the correlation until just a few months ago. My entire life, I've been working, most of my life, I've been working in housekeeping, my adult working life. And I always gravitated toward the maintenance man and the maintenance department. And I always thought that I gravitated toward them because I worked in housekeeping, and housekeeping and maintenance have to be married, so to speak, in order to be successful in the hotel industry. And I just made that correlation not too long ago that maintenance man found me, and I always gravitate toward the maintenance department and the maintenance man. And I always seem to have an excellent relationship with the maintenance people, you know, like it seemed that I gravitate toward. And on the other side of the spectrum, another correlation that I made a couple of years ago that I didn't make it, my husband made it. Whenever I get lost as an adult, when I'm driving, I would have these severe panic attacks, and where I would cry and scream and like I would literally scream and cry in the car when I'm lost. And I made the correlation, my husband made the correlation, when you was 8, 9 years old, you was lost in the streets of New York City. You was walking around New York all by yourself, and you was lost. So that's why you panic when you're lost now. So now that I made that correlation, when I'm lost, I remind myself, you know what? I'm an adult. I have a phone. I have a car. I have $2 in my pocket. I could defend myself. I'm not that little girl anymore. I'm not that 9-year-old girl lost in New York. I'm a grown woman, and I can defend myself. I'm not that little girl. So making those correlations, it's really, really healing, you know? So thank you for sharing about the orange color, because I remember the maintenance man and the getting lost and the panic attacks when I get lost. Oh, it hasn't happened in a long time since I made the correlation, so I just wanted to share that.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. A lot of times we can't get the correlation when we're younger. I mean, we just can't being out of it for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a little bit slow. It took me years. Well, I was born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, so which was the withdrawal from my mother's addiction, you know. So I'm a little slow, but I have no shame. I have no shame. Thank you so much.
I would say you're very bright. Yeah. No, we're so honored that we could be here tonight and hear your story. And I mean, there's got to be so many challenges to being born with an addiction. I mean, that's just not how babies are supposed to start life.
Yes,
you know, thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank
I
you so much for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, we really enjoyed this. We really enjoyed having you on. And I'm glad that I got to be on and hear your story. So, yeah, we'll have to look you up. Like I said, my computer's doing some weird things right now. I don't know. I can't get my little mouse to go.
So
as soon as I can get it going, I'll get you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Please find me. Please feel free to find me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're welcome to look around, too. I think a lot of times you just get these remote, impossible people that you might know or whatever. So, it's always fun to make new connections and meet people. So you're still, you've stayed in Florida pretty much because you're out in Florida.
Yes.
So.
My son lives here in Florida. He's actually staying with me now and his family because they were displaced not too long ago. You know how the rents went up and all that stuff. And my daughter's in Indianapolis. She's teaching at Butler University. She's teaching creative writing. She's got 100 days sober. I'm so proud of her. I'm so happy for her. I'm so happy for her, and I'm so proud of my son, and he's got two beautiful children and a wife, and my daughter's dating seriously, and I'm so happy for my kids. I mean, they have a lot of generational trauma, but they're doing it. They're okay. They're okay. Okay, I mean, as okay gets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you... You trying to give them a different life made a difference. You may not have been perfect all the time, and you're not perfect. None of us are.
Yeah.
But you tried, and that's very
now
admirable.
I know better. Now I know better. Now I do better.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, good. And it must be so fun having those grandbabies so close by, too.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
Yes. Yeah, ask anybody on NASCA. I talk about grandbabies. I'm big into my grandbabies, too. I have 6 of them, so they're the best.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say, I wish we could have done that first, because the raising kids was kind of a hard job. The grandparent thing is a lot more fun.
A whole lot more fun.
Yeah.
A whole lot. My daughter told me today, because I talk to her almost every day. My daughter told me today, I wish I would have had it like Morgan. I'm like, you didn't have a grandmother.
Right. Yeah. So you get to show them what being a grandmother is all about and just spoil the grandbaby.
Yes.
That's your job.
Yes, ma'am. That's my job. That's my first job. That's my number one job.
Yeah. Well, enjoy.
Thank you again.
You guys have
a great night.
Yes. Thank
you.
You
guys have a great,
so
great night.
On.
Thank you.
Good night. And stay in touch.
Good night.
Oh, and anytime. Good night. And
good
as we say, you know, if you all see something, please say something. We all could make a difference in children's lives and our communities or in our neighborhoods. So pay attention to what you're doing.